Some rare good news this year. An agreement has been made between the UK and the EU. Zero tariff, zero quota deal. Many said it wasn't possible. But does it pass the sovereignty test? Let's speak to Stephen Barrett, who is a commercial barrister at Radcliffe Chambers. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Please don't tell me that you sacrificed your Christmas to read that wretchedly long tome.
It's what lawyers do, I'm afraid.
Did you do it in between eggnogs?
No, I have a small daughter and I was sober anyway, so I'm afraid it's just what we do.
You're doing a great national service by having read that thing. I haven't read it. I'm waiting for the audiobook or maybe the movie, but you've been through it. I mean, first of all, you know, politically, I think that we would have heard from the Tory Brexiteers, the ERG group, if there were any major causes for concern, because they've given it a cursory glance. However, they are not top lawyers. You are. What's your overview of what you've seen?
So I thought it would be helpful to have a voice that is politically neutral. And I've only looked at this as a lawyer. But as a lawyer, this treaty is a totally new relationship. It completely restores sovereignty. I think it's quite important that people hear that. There are some things in it. There's a lot of detail in it, and I could talk for hours about it. It's very long. But it is quite important that all of those worries people had during the very long period, that somehow sovereignty would be taken away, or it would be lessened or fettered or reduced. That's not proved true in the end. In the end, there is a brand new agreement under international law, and both parties are sovereign to that. The EU and the UK, both sovereign.
And that is perhaps everything that many on the Brexit side of the argument want to hear. However, going through that text in detail, you wrote brilliantly about this in the Spectator magazine. I would direct many people that find this topic of interest to read the Spectator online or get the magazine, because this is where I actually have discovered the work that you've been doing. In the article, you sort of do point out that, you know, historically the EU have been notorious for creating rabbit holes and trapdoors within treaties. I mean, are there any hidden traps there that we should be concerned about, or legal grey area that might give the EU a bit of a stick to beat us with in the coming years?
Yes, I mean, I didn't want to criticise or take a political stance on it, but it's true to say that the EU acts in this way. It likes to, or tries to, have mechanisms for influencing the legal systems of people that it makes treaties with. There are none I see that survive in this treaty. You can read it like a legal archaeologist and go through and find out bits where they were clearly trying to get things in. The words level playing field survive. There isn't really a legal level playing field,
and that's because there isn't a mechanism that the EU can deploy to punish Britain for, let's say, supporting a particular industry.
No, so subsidies is probably the closest area where we get some form of relationship. They can pop up in our courts to argue that we've oversubsidized. And we can do the same in their courts, but it isn't, it's using our laws and using our systems to do that. Ultimately, I do think it's quite important that although there is a lot of technical detail, it is a restored sovereign relationship between two sovereign states. They have mechanisms for talking to each other, which in the article, I called it diplomacy, not law. Because in law, it's really an or what test. If you write down something, we can write down all sorts of things. I might write down that I'm committed to your health and happiness, which I probably am. Unless there's some sort of mechanism for you to make me, you know, give you money or actually care for you or let you in my house if you knock on the door, then that's just some words written on a piece of paper. That's diplomacy or politics or morality, not law. And it's quite important, I think, that people realise that there is that distinction.
And the impression I got from the Prime Minister's comments when he announced that the deal had been achieved was that actually a lot of the sort of anti-competitive measures would probably be at the extreme end if they were to be pursued in the courts, such as, you know, the way that the Chinese dump steel in a completely unfair and disproportionate way. So it's not like we should be fearful there'll be a court case every time we do something good for the British economy.
Yes, I think what confused a lot of lawyers as soon as this came out is that there is a mechanism for ending the agreement if there is a breach or perceived breach of human rights. There is a mechanism for ending the agreement anyway. So that looks, it's in something called Inst 35, this one. It's just a bit of theatre. It isn't a legal change on anything. And the way that it's drafted, you'd have to have some pretty serious breach. I mean, either I don't believe on a maybe this is getting a bit political, but I don't think it's terribly
controversial. Come on, this is talk radio, Steve. Knock yourself out.
Neither the UK nor the EU are rogue nations.
Yeah, yeah.
Neither's going to be doing anything bizarre or extreme. It's a bit like if you said you'd sell me your fridge and I said, oh, OK, I'll buy you a fridge. And then we go to my kitchen and we write down the contract and you insist on putting in a clause saying that I mustn't murder you. Well, for a start, I wasn't going to murder you. For a second, it's against the law anyway for me to murder you.
Yeah.
But if you come away from that kitchen table negotiation and you hold up your piece of paper and you say, I'm very lucky, I've got a clause saying he's not going to murder me, that's politics, not law, I think. So whilst it is a legal text, there's quite a few political bits, but they shouldn't worry anybody on the law. In law, this is a treaty which establishes sovereignty between two sovereign nations.
And of course, you know, trading between nations always involves discretion, doesn't it? And the interpretation of the spirit of any trade deal. And that's not going to be exclusive to the UK and the EU. In fact, it's been well reported that EU states often ignore EU rules around state aid and other economic measures whilst within the bloc. So the bottom line is that there's always a little bit of wiggle room when it comes to, the law and the spirit thereof.
Yes, the ECJ exists as a court inside the EU because EU law is constantly broken between member states. So it's got a very busy job going around between the 27 members enforcing the law. That's its job. What matters for us is in our treaty, there's nothing like that. There's no court to enforce this treaty.
Yeah.
Back in international law, at the extreme end of what is mostly diplomacy, you have the option of arbitration. But a point I made, and I think probably, I mean, the arbitration community is quite small. I'm in it. I'm not grand enough to make the list of people who can sit on the panels. But it's quite clear once you know the arbitration community that you just couldn't arbitrate every bit of this treaty. You just run out of people to actually sit and do it. So this is disputes between the EU and the UK are going to have to be solved on a diplomatic level, on a political level.
And this is something that's often ignored across the field of law, isn't it? Which is the importance of discretion and goodwill.
Yes. I mean, you're dragging me back into politics. One of the, I don't like goodwill clauses in contracts. English law doesn't really do them because we think that they're a bit silly. By the time you get to somebody breaching goodwill, it's all flown out the window.
Well, exactly. But that isn't the joy of the goodwill that what I'm angling for is the idea that it's not adumbrated and, there chiseled out in stone, but it's just the spirit of the relationship, which you can't legislate for, but which we would assume, as you said, given that we're not rogue states, we will somehow adhere to where possible.
Yes. And maybe I shouldn't be rude about the bits of the treaty that make these declarations, because they are politically important and they do remind everybody that we are going to be friends moving forward and we've got some serious challenges that face all of us.
Do you know what it is? It's the clever lawyers are putting that language in to keep the idiot politicians happy. Now, Stephen.
I'm not going to comment on that.
I love your quite rightly biting your lip there. Final thought: ought we to be concerned that this document has been drafted so rapidly and, in the case of so many, on very little sleep?
Well, to be honest, that's why I read it, and that's why quite a few lawyers are reading it. I certainly don't want anybody thinking I'm very grand. There are very grand lawyers who are reading this right now in the UK, and people are going through this with a fine-tooth comb. I found a typo on page 164. You know, apparently there's a bit of copy-paste text in one of the annexes, which is out of date, about computers. We are reading this rapidly. The strength of the United Kingdom is that we have one of, I would say, the best legal industry in the world. We have the finest lawyers in the world here. And a lot of them are doing what I did, which is entirely for free, reading this thing and double checking. Their parliamentarians will be very well served when they come to vote on this. The fact that it has to be done at speed is a political thing.
Stephen, a final. Is there any recourse should errors be found? I mean, we're not going to go back into a full-scale negotiation, but if anything had been scribbled down in haste that was erroneous in some way, but not politically sensitive, is there scope for giving this a bit of a tidy up, a little bit of a sub-edit on this document?
Yes. So it calls itself, it is the new relationship, and it sets itself up as like a parent document, if you like. But it acknowledges that there may be sub-agreements that come in future, and those can tweak and change bits that came that haven't worked very well or that were badly written, and they can add in extra things. There are things missing from this, and quite rightly they need to be put in. But it is just on a not a political comment, but on a professional level. It is amazing how quickly this thing has been done. Quite a lot of lawyers are irritated with how it's numbered. So all the articles, it's not like article 1, 2, 3, 4. They've all got silly names and it jumps around. I actually think that's probably for a very clever reason. But even so, I'd have a lot of sympathy with whoever drafted this, because it's very hard to do in that length of time.
Well, indeed, I consider it to be a triumph of statesmanship that they did get this across the line. But it is a triumph for that legal expertise on both sides of the channel as well. And Stephen, thank you for reading it so that we don't have to. It's been brilliant to talk to you. Stephen Barrett is the commercial barrister at Radcliffe Chambers, who has written for The Spectator magazine, and he's giving it the thumbs up for sovereignty.